Greetings, fellow Portlanders. From the Emerson News Network, this is Legion of News.
Atop the milk packing district in the heart of beautiful southeast Portland, Oregon. This, my friends, is Legion of News, a one-hour distillation of all important knowledge from everywhere. My name is Rick Emerson alongside Don Taylor, who is, even now as I speak these words to you, preparing information on a vast swath of happenings, including, but not limited to, the following.
Portland cops prepare to make with the tear gas and the beatings. A Portland man finally realizes the lottery ticket stuck to his fridge is worth $21 million. And a heckler calls Senate candidate Elizabeth Warren a socialist whore.
As always, my friends, have no doubt that this conglomeration of factual discourse and ideological screed will render you shocked, amazed, enraptured, and demonstrably more intelligent than when you began this hour. And now, without further ado, brace yourselves, for this is Legion of News.
Good afternoon. I'm Dawn Taylor, and this is absolutely everything you need to know for Friday, November 4th, 2011. Portland Police Chief Michael Reese has issued a directive that every sworn officer have their bureau-issued uniforms, helmet, baton, and gas mask on hand starting today.
Done and done.
Reese said all sworn members should be prepared to deploy with their required equipment in a timely manner. I am also reaching out to those other agencies to other agencies, asking for mutual aid agreements for this prolonged event. He said the goal remains a peaceful resolution to occupy Portland.
Probably not strictly speaking true.
We will continue to reach out to protesters to ask for their cooperation for permitted marches. We will continue to work with the mayor's office to bring about a peaceful resolution that accommodates all people's rights while ensuring the city's public safety needs are met. Spokesman Lieutenant Robert King said the chief's directive was not an additional issuance of equipment. It's aimed at police not usually in uniform, like detectives and other plainclothes officers. Reese wants that equipment kept in their lockers or at work or in their patrol cars.
Are we reading interoffice memos now? Like, is it going to be that? And don't take anything from the refrigerator that doesn't have your name on it. Christ.
But it's like, it's all, basically he's just telling like plainclothes officers and stuff, you might need your helmet and your tear gas because we may be calling everyone out at a moment's notice to make with the beatings.
I'm confused. Is there going to be a bludgeoning or not?
Well, I don't know. What's interesting to me is there, I mean, you know there's more going on behind the scenes than we're aware of because Mike Reese just announced that he may be running for mayor against Sam Adams.
Yes.
So now he
as
comes
out. As a law
out,
and order candidate, Don.
Yes. And so now he makes this announcement that all the cops have to be on the ready in case, you know, we have to go beat on all of those ungodly hippies that Sam Adams is allowing to be in our parks.
Well, Don, it sounds like we need to start taking out trash the other 2 weeks of the month. Zam.
Yeah.
There you go. I should be writing for that guy.
You should.
Oh, man. Hey, I'm available. Just Rick Emerson can be bought.
King did say the directive could be interpreted to mean that Reese views Occupy Portland as needing an extraordinary effort with people ready to respond. In his directive, Reese specifically mentioned a Wednesday evening Occupy Portland march that he felt took a different tone than previous marches and rallies. He wrote, "Last night, many of you were involved in the unpermitted march that occurred throughout downtown and across the bridge. The tone of this march seemed to change from previous events, and many in the crowd seemed confrontational, provoking motorists and police."
Here's the thing, is when they're saying that they want a peaceful resolution of this or that they're hoping it resolves without somebody having to, you know, to be with the stick and the ow and the oh, I'm bruised, that's not true for anybody. It's not true for the police, who
probably have a lot of built-up stress and just are waiting on a whale on a guy. It's probably not true for the protesters themselves, who are there hoping, and I understand why, but who are there hoping to instigate some sort of a standoff or confrontation with the police, because that's the only way that anything ever gets done.
Well, some of them are hoping for that. I think, honestly, the majority of the Occupy Portland protesters, at least, seem to mostly just be about making a public statement. They don't want, I honestly think that, because even in the Pearl, what happened in the Pearl, the bulk of the protesters there were trying to get the rabble rousers to knock it the hell off. They're like going, you're going to ruin it for everyone. Except, and then there were some guys who were like, we're going to just pick some designated people to get arrested and they're going to be jerks. And then we're going to, and it's like, and there, but there were a large number of other people going, really, we don't want to be beaten.
Yeah.
We'd really rather not be beaten. But we're about like getting attention, not necessarily that kind of attention.
See, but here's the thing, is really there's no better way to get attention than just to get yourself fire hosed on television. And I'm just saying as a pragmatic matter, just as a function of practicality, nonviolence never changes anything. Ever. The only way that anything ever changes is through you doing violence to somebody else or violence being done to you and it being captured by television cameras and broadcast on the news. That is, I think, I mean, not to become overly sociology 101 about it or whatever, but I think even the civil rights era, I think one would have to acknowledge that a lot of the results of the civil rights era and a lot of the change that came from that wasn't from nonviolent resistance. It was from nonviolent resistors having police dogs sicked on them and everybody in the rest of the country going, oh, no, we gotta knock that off. We gotta stop that. So violence always happens. It has to happen on one side or the other for anything, because you just can't get anybody to take the issue seriously otherwise. I'm not suggesting that there should be wholesale looting or firebombing. I mean, I'm not saying that.
That would be bad.
I'm just saying, because otherwise it's just a bunch of guys standing on a corner for days on end. And I mean, really, you can see that in my neighborhood all the time. Nothing ever changes there. So, you know,
I don't think in this particular case, though, them getting arrested and beaten and tear gas is going to change anything either.
No, but it gets people more interested. It gets people more invested in the story, and it underscores the importance of the issue. I'm just saying as a matter, look, it doesn't matter what side you're on. I'm just saying as a matter of media relations and as a matter of expediting, forcing the issue is never forced until it comes down to a guy getting a mouthful of teeth.
Also, traditionally, there have been cases where local police agencies and even governmental agencies have had, let's call them ringers, in the groups that kind of started poking things to get things a little bit more confrontational, so the cops can wade in and make with the tear gas.
That's what I'm saying. There's always so the idea that neither side wants any sort of standoff or confrontation, or they don't want a flashpoint, is just, I think that's wrong.
I'm fairly sure
on all corners.
I'm fairly sure the cops do. I mean,
if I was a protester, I'd want it.
The city probably doesn't, because lawsuits always end up resulting from that sort of thing, and it costs money. But it's like the cops always seem to be very itchy to like use all of their toys and their tasers and their tear gas and their giant boots.
If I was giant boots.
Boots.
I said something else there.
No.
I thought you were in full on Art Alexakis mode with that. I'm just saying, if I was a protester, and this is just my read on the situation, that I would be pushing for it too. I would be agitating I would be doing everything I could to instigate some sort of brutality on the part of the police officers, because that is, I'm just saying this from an objective, non-ideological driven stance. I'm just speaking. The mechanics of social change and media are such that if it's a peaceful protest, no one cares. And nothing ever. And plus, here's the other thing. If it's a peaceful protest and it's like they're not really screwing anything up, I mean, they're screwing up traffic, I guess. And there's, some minor violence that's been reported or alleged or whatever.
But and our park blocks are unsightly.
Yeah, that's, you know, and there's refuse everywhere. But if there's no actual conflagration happening, or there's no actual violent incidents taking place, then really, what does it matter to the rest of the country if this continues to go on for another 6 months? I mean, what motive do they have? What impetus do they have to come to any sort of a resolution or to examine the issue seriously? So that's the only way you can force people in America to do anything, is just to set fire to them, you know, figuratively speaking. To put the fire to their feet and then, and then their
head. Basically the idea would be to get together in your like Portland, Occupy Portland group, figure out who the guys are that you really don't like very much.
Yes.
The really annoying hippies, and encourage them to go and rouse a little rabble.
Yes.
And get gas.
That's exactly what I would
do. And then
doing.
You win on both counts. You get the attention. The cops look like violent, jackbooted thugs. And you got rid of, like, Hacky Sack Jim with his patchouli scent and his... And his whatnot.
Well, as Abby Hoffman used to say, himself a veteran of the 68 Chicago riots, where he was set upon by jackbooted thugs, which was exactly his plan. You know, when people say give peace a chance, he said, you know, peace, nobody ever won anything through peace. So, I'm just saying.
I believe that in the year and a half we've been here, I peacefully won your love.
I'm only going to be here for 3 more days. If I don't get to see brutality now, when is it going to happen? That's really the bottom line here.
You're going to come back from Mexico and everything will just have been burnt to a
It'll
ground.
It'll be a smoldering husk of a city and everybody will be in the ICU and I will have missed the fun.
It'll be nothing but zombies.
That's right.
And you won't be prepared.
That's what I'm saying.
A man was arrested outside an Oregon City apartment early Friday morning after a woman reported to police that he was peering into her window and masturbating. Officers rolled up quietly and started searching the complex at 750 Cascade Avenue in Oregon City. An officer saw a man looking into the bedroom window of another apartment unit. The man appeared to be masturbating.
He appeared to be masturbating.
Well, I guess if you're like down, you're in
your
car.
He also appeared to be pole starting a tiny, tiny lawnmower that was in his pants.
He was shaking up a can of whipped cream.
Uh-huh.
In front of his pants. The officer called to the man, who raised his hands. His pants zipper was undone. When asked what he was doing, the man replied, quote, "Nothing good."
Well, that's either true or sad or an acknowledgement of one's own issues or an indication that maybe he's doing it wrong.
Anthony Michael Johnson was accused of 2 counts each of invasion of personal privacy and second-degree criminal trespass. He was arrested last June on similar accusations after he was taken into custody after complaints from women living near his home in the 500 block of Pleasant Avenue.
Uh-huh.
In Oregon
City. All right, so there you go. So they got a report. They go there. The guy's giving it what for, like a rabid weasel. Mm-hmm. And then they say, "You there, what are you doing?" He says,
"Nothing good."
Nothing good. And they said, "All right then, Sonny Jim, in the back of the car."
Yeah.
Okay.
And now Oregon City is safe once again.
All right. He was peering in a window, by the way.
Peering.
Not looking, not staring. Peering. Because peering is what you do when you're sinister.
Yeah.
You know, when you're skullduggerous.
He was, well, he's peeping.
Yes.
He was a peeping Tom, so he was peeping.
Nobody ever peeps, like, in a positive way.
No.
It's never, you know, it's never like, well, the police officer who was peeping around the neighborhood caught the guy red-handed just as he was about to abscond with my Bentley. It's always a guy was peeping in there trying to catch my daughter and her under things.
I'm going to try and start using peeping more often. Okay. I'm just in other terms saying, like, and I was peeping at my lunch salad before I ate it.
Okay.
Just try and, you know, see, now I'm obsessed with what the actual activity of looking at something, what it is specifically that makes it peeping.
Well, let's find out. Shall we ask Mrs. Webster and...
Oh, please.
Who's Miriam?
Miriam, that was Webster's longtime bachelor companion.
You're making that up.
Jasper Miriam.
Well, it's like
they lived together in a lovely home in the suburbs, and they enjoyed words.
It's like it's like how there's Philip Michael Thomas, and then Don Johnson.
Blue Diamond Almond.
And what? Then there's and then there's your George Michael and your Andrew Ridgely.
Yeah.
There's your Noah Webster, and then there's your
the other guy.
Your Aloysius Merriam.
Yeah.
Let's see. Peep. Do you want verb?
He was like the Combs to Hannity.
Exactly.
He didn't get any of the credit.
Hannity and Combs. Looking quickly and wait, here's the tell. This is really the defining characteristic of peeping.
Okay.
Peep, verb. Look quickly and furtively at something, especially through a narrow opening.
Okay.
That's odd. So apparently you can't peep through a fully open window. The window's just got to be open a crack.
Right, and you have to be up to nothing. You have to be up to no good, basically, because you're being furtive.
And then listen to the example they give. You know, sometimes they go, use it in a sentence, please. The sentence they use is, because it can also be a noun as in a momentary or partial view of something. So in other words, it could be a verb to do, and then the peep is like the actual sight.
Yeah.
The sentence they use it in is, black curls and a peep of gold earring.
I don't like that at all.
All right.
Because that just means glimpse.
I don't think
peep really means glimpse.
Well, that makes it sound like it's an amount. How much gold?
Yeah.
A peep.
A peep.
There's 15 peeps in a peck.
And then there's your Halloween peeps, and then that confuses the whole issue even further.
Let's not forget my...
Why are they called... Well, I guess they were originally called peeps because they look like little chicks. But then they make the the bunny peeps, which makes no sense at all if they're called peeps. We should probably move on to another news story.
Let's move along.
Okay,
because I was about to say, hey, look over there, and then play something horrible. So you skirted death by just moments right there.
President Obama expresses optimism that Europe can get its financial woes resolved. Speaking at the G20 summit in France, the president explained America has a lot of stake in this, too.
If Europe isn't growing, it's harder for us to do what we need to do for the American people, creating jobs, lifting up the middle class, and putting our fiscal house in order.
See, I like the fact that he doesn't pretend to really be their friend. He just says, look, we all need jobs, and that means you have to get off your ass. Because if you're not working, we're not working. So hop to it, Frenchie.
We're the United States.
That's
France.
Right. Exactly. Get off your cheese-eating ass and go mow something.
The president said Europe's leaders had laid a foundation for rescuing its economy.
Make no mistake, there is more hard work ahead and more difficult choices to make. But our European partners have laid a foundation on which to build.
Make no mistake, we will bomb every one of you if you don't get jobs today.
A Portland man found an Oregon lottery ticket worth $21.8 million hanging on his refrigerator door. It had been there for 3 months. Leland Hansen said lottery officials see he was about to...
Let's try that again.
Okay, Leland Hansen told lottery officials he was about to pay his veterinarian when he noticed the lottery tickets on his fridge and decided to see if there was a little extra money there. A coworker said Hansen went to work at the city of Portland and gave a scheduled presentation on Wednesday. At the end of the presentation, he told everyone in the room he had won $22 million and was quitting his job.
So what do you mean he went to see if there was a little extra money there?
Well, as you do. I mean, I have bought lottery tickets occasionally and always just end up leaving them laying around. And I don't ever, like, check on them in a timely fashion. And then I go...
Oh, it wasn't like a scratching thing. It was like
a
Powerball
kind
thing.
Of a thing.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
It was megabucks.
And he thought, well, I might as well check.
You know, I got this damn vet bill. Maybe there's $50, you know, on one of these. Maybe I got lucky.
Why would you buy your lottery tickets and then just make checking them an afterthought?
Patrick does that. Patrick will be buying a soda somewhere, and he'll decide, yeah, you know, I'll buy a Powerball ticket, and he'll buy it.
And then
he'll
not check it.
He'll come home, he'll just throw it on, like, the table, the dresser in the bedroom with his keys and his change and stuff. And, like, 2 months later, I'll go, okay, these five lottery tickets that are sitting here, did you ever? He's like, no, I don't know. Why don't you give those to me? I'll go see if we want anything.
See, here's the thing about that. Now you've gone and said that Patrick does it, so it's going to be like I'm dogging on Patrick. But again, just objectively speaking, the weird thing about that is very addiction-style behavior, because that indicates that the thrill doesn't come from having the thing. The thrill comes from the pursuit of the thing and buying the thing. So it is the ritualistic aspect of purchasing your Powerball ticket as opposed to checking it. Now, not that you wouldn't want $1 billion.
See, I don't think he really gets a thrill out of buying it. I think it's more, you know how in the commercials it says, do not use this as a financial plan or
yes,
whatever it is? Patrick uses it as a financial plan. He just says,
I plan to be poor.
We're really poor. We're really, really poor. And then he'll see one of those billboards and go, you know, that Powerball's up to $34 million. What the hell? I'll spend a buck.
What a return on my investment that would be.
Yeah. And so then he buys it. And then because he's not really emotionally invested in it, he just tosses it on the table and then doesn't think about it again.
Okay. Fair enough.
And then I go,
shouldn't
remember that whole thing about us being really poor? Maybe we won a whole lot of money.
Look in that there.
Yeah. So the guy said, maybe I got some money. So he went and he checked. And then on Wednesday,
I hate this guy.
He went to his, but I love the fact that he did what everybody says they're going to do. He went to his job. He gave a scheduled presentation in front of his coworkers. And then at the end of that, he told everyone in the room he'd won the lottery and was quitting.
By the way, there's your presentation. Also, you can suck it. That should have been his last PowerPoint frame. And you'll see here in chart A, this is you and that's me. You are sucking it right there. And then that's me leaving.
Yeah, the people I hate are the ones who go, well, I'm not going to quit my job.
No.
I love being a plumber.
That's
You're
always
like,
a
really?
Lie. Yeah.
Really?
No.
He had bought the July 30th Megabucks ticket. And he brought it to the Salem Lottery office on Thursday. The lottery says Hansen chose the cash-out option and received a one-time payment of $10.9 million before taxes were withheld. He had purchased the $1 ticket at a North Portland convenience store.
Damn it!
I bought a lot of tickets in North Portland when I lived there, and I never won a damn thing.
Yeah, here's the thing is, and also, because I am a little bit the same way, I think it is human nature, that you always, you run through it in your own head of, would I choose the lump sum or would I choose the ongoing payment? And I think, of course, the conventional wisdom is that you always take the lump sum, because the lump sum, if invested, then gives you such, you know, even though it's less money, you can get a substantial return. Even now,
you also,
can get a
also, if you
return.
Decide to get the payout over 20 years, you are trusting that the lottery program is still going to be solvent over the next 12 years and will be able to pay you.
Oh, I trust that implicitly. I trust that more than I trust anything. Idiots always gamble. Don't get me wrong. No offense, Patrick. Idiots and poor people gamble like nobody. If I could invest in the lottery right now, if the state-run or government-run lottery was a thing in which I could buy stock, I would liquidate every single share of everything I have, and I would put that into just booze and lottery tickets like tomorrow. But I don't think it's a possibility.
I don't buy them for the same reason that I don't like play a video poker or anything like that. I understand intellectually that there is no such thing as luck, that it is all pure random chaos and happenstance, and, you know, it's just
there's luck as a
chance.
As a concept.
But I understand intellectually but it seems like...
I mean, it is luck because you can't influence it.
Right. But it doesn't it seem like there are people who are luckier than other people?
Well, actually, it's funny you say that, Don. There was actually a story from a reputable news source. There was a story that came out... I'm surprised we didn't talk about this, actually. We're falling down on the job. We suck. We should be destroyed. There was a story that came out like 3 weeks ago, and it was like in the AP or something, where there was a woman in Texas who lottery officials are... She didn't do anything illegal, but lottery officials are speaking to her now because she had like a degree in advanced, like, you know, mind-boggling astro science math or something. But she found that she had won lottery prizes in excess of $50,000 like 7 times over the last 9 years. And they have come to believe that she had cracked some sort of algorithm in the system itself, not in terms of the numbers that are drawn, but in terms of numbers that are. I think it had something to do with numbers that were in fact pre-selected by the system and some of the ancillary awards or prizes that you get from the state of Texas. I'm almost certain it was Texas, and I'm mangling the whole story, so now I'm going to have to go find it and read it. Because it's one of those things that you hear and you go, well, that can't be true. It must be an urban legend. But I swear to God, it was like the AP or like UPI or somebody had it.
Well, I'm just talking about the thing that we all know people that, like, they go to a stereo store opening and they end up coming home with, like, a free door prize with the stereo. Like, every single time they do something like that. Or, like, they buy scratcher tickets for lottery things, and it's like $5 here, $100 there, $300 there. And I'm like going, and I never, ever, ever have won anything from any of those things. I have terrible luck when it comes to that stuff.
Yeah.
And I know that. So I just gave up at some point.
But see, I think perceptually speaking, you just became a real thinky program today. What's up with that?
Yeah, sometimes we're like that.
All right.
It's Friday. It's the end of the week. You're about to go...
It's opposite day.
You're about to go off to the jungle.
That's
and
true.
And be gone for like a week and just lay in the sun and, you know, drink virgin Mai Tais or whatever.
I saw the weirdest picture of the place I'm going to. I hadn't actually seen any photos of it. I have a friend of mine, my pal Roger, has gone to this place.
Did you determine that it is indeed Chichen Itza, or is it someplace different?
No, it's a town near Chichen Itza. Okay. It's some small place that's just filled with dust and poor people. And me, with my mighty American dollars.
Maybe that, monkeys.
Here's the thing. You know what the great thing about going to Mexico is? It's like being in America, like, 1997. You know, it's like I'm taking a vacation to the Clinton administration. Oh, look at my money. It buys so much. It's my friend Roger, Roger Bridges, who I should give credit. Roger Bridges, who did the awesome cover art for Zombie Economics. He has gone to this city. He's like, hey, are you going to this place? And I said, yeah. And he goes, here's a photo. And he sent me a photo of it. And it was just, it's one of those places that doesn't look real. Like, it looks like it's out of a Harry Potter book or something. I'll show you the picture that he sent me. He's like, hey, here's like a... I don't know. It's like a lagoon in a cave or something. And it's like the cave has got like a hole in the top of it where the sun shines in. It's like some weird Raiders of the Lost Ark.
You're not actually going to be staying
Pirates
in the cave.
Of the
You're
Caribbean
visiting the cave.
It's like a thing you see. It's down the road.
All right.
It's bizarre. It's like one of those places that, like, I don't know, that, like, David Attenborough would be, you know, and here lives one of the most rarefied pupa of all time, you know, and it's all...
So a large part, I'm getting the idea that a large part of your wife's joy at planning a vacation is just finding some experience that will make you intensely uncomfortable.
Yes. Well, I would say that's about 98%.
This time it's like, I'm going to make him go in a cave.
Yeah. No, and she actually told me, yes, she said, so how many pairs of swim trunks are you bringing? And I said... what do you mean? And she said, how many pairs of swim trunks do you own? And I said, none. And she said, why? And I said, because why would I ever need those? Like, it, why? In, I own one pair of pants that aren't long. I own one pair of shorts. And that is because I had to have some to go to Crew Fest 2 a couple years ago because it was 121 degrees. That's it. Everything else I own goes all the way to my ankles. So I have nothing. I'm basically swimming like an Amish girl. But
you get one of those old-timey bathing costumes.
With like a little cap.
Yeah.
And I can dive off a ramp in Atlantic City. Anyway, so it's all about making me... you should see the place she tried to take me. I'll, the next hour, we don't have time to do this now because it's already 12:30 because we're wasting our lives. Next hour, I will show you the place I'm going or one of the photos of it. And then I'll show you the place she tried to take me, which is ludicrous. Which is just... Which is so off the charts insane. All right, anyway.
Okay. Let's do our science news.
All right. So forth. Somebody says the thing I'm describing is called a C-note. C-E-N-O-T-E.
Sure.
Cenote?
I don't know.
Cenote? I don't know. I got nothing. All right. Here's Don Taylor.
Identifying a good glass of whiskey requires attention to color, aroma, and taste, and it takes some experience to learn. Spectroscopic tools can now automate this process, but most of them are complicated to use. However, Praveen Ashok of the University of St. Andrews in Scotland have proposed a simple portable device that tests whiskey or any other beverage without losing any of it to evaporation. The device is a microfluidic chip that's made of a type of clear plastic. Four channels are cut into the plastic. One is in the top for the whiskey to go in. This leads to an exit channel on one side, which lets the user pull liquid through with a suction syringe. Two more channels are at right angles to the inlet. One allows for a fiber optic cable to carry a laser beam, while the other carries the signal to the spectrometer. The researchers say they're able to analyze the liquor in about a minute. For whiskey to be considered whiskey, it has to have at least 40% alcohol. Most interesting was the fluorescent background produced when the laser light hit the whiskey. It's very different for different types of the drink. This is because the organics, which are called congeners, in whiskey differ according to the grains that are used to distill it, and as well as the kind of barrels it was aged in and even how old it is. This means that the device could test whiskeys for authenticity and tell that if a shot really is Jack Daniel's, 30-year-old Johnny Walker, or some kind of colored moonshine that somebody's trying to pass off as top.
So this is so
liquor.
You can test your booze without wasting any of the precious intoxication-giving alcohol.
Yeah. Or without being one of those crazy super smeller guys whose entire job is just looking at and smelling the whiskey to, like, testing.
He's telling you that he's getting notes of pepper
or
something. So if I had my Johnny Walker Blue here, for example, they could test that and tell me exactly, I don't know, it's like 75-year-old scotch or something. And then I would put it back in my garage where I don't drink it.
Okay. That seems a shame.
I just keep it to annoy people.
I don't really care that much because I don't like scotch, but I can see how a scotch person might find that kind of
irritating. No, I have it's not a huge bottle, but it's a good sized bottle of Johnny Walker Blue, which I guess it couldn't be a huge bottle because apparently it's like more expensive than gold. It is the rarest of the, you know, whatever of the Johnny Walkers. So much so that I didn't think it was real until a guy it brought some to the studio a few years ago to give to Scotty J, and I then took it from him, and so that belongs to me now.
Because you knew that Scotty J was just going to just send it straight down his gullet and not appreciate it.
Well, he brought him this sampler pack. It was Johnny Walker Green, Black, Blue, and Gold, red. No, it was a.
There is a Johnny Walker red.
Red.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, red, green, blue, and black, and there had been this episode of The West Wing in which Leo McGarry rhapsodized, in which Aaron Sorkin, via Leo McGarry, rhapsodized about being an alcoholic and the taste of Johnny Walker Blue, and he was talking about the various kinds of Johnny Walkers, and he said Johnny Walker Blue is 75-year-old scotch, and he said it with this great sort of smoky delivery. Anyway, so then a listener brought, it's like, hey, Scotty J, I brought you some Johnny Walker green and black and blue. And I'm like, I'll take that. Thank you. And then I left it on my desk at CBS, and people would come in and they would ask if it was Johnny Walker Blue. And I'd say, yes, it is. And they'd say, I've never even seen that. I heard it's fantastic. I'd say, me too. Never going to drink it.
Well, an e-reader that doesn't need an external power supply, at least when used outdoors, and is flexible and tough, has been unveiled in Japan by AU Optronics. AU Optronics, a Taiwanese company, has been showing off displays, but the concept e-reader seems to have stolen the show at the FPD International Trade Show in Yokohama, Japan. It's 6 inches across and made from thin film transistor e-paper that includes a photovoltaic cell. The company says it's boosted the efficiency of the cell, which produces about 1 watt, and the battery itself weighs in at only 0.3 ounces. The combination of flexibility, lightness, and durability means it won't matter if it gets dropped. There is no word yet on whether or not it's waterproof. The only downside of the solar battery is that it won't work well indoors. There is an external rechargeable battery for the device that does take up energy from indoor lighting. The company hasn't said when or if it will commercialize the technology, but it does offer a glimpse into what the future of e-readers may look like.
By the way, this is probably a good time to say you're listening to Legion of News here at Cascadia.fm. Thank you for joining us. Coming up now, Science on the March. Later on this hour, your entertainment news. And next hour, the Rick Emerson radio program. Next hour, Snuff Watch, Taser Watch, and Mr. Big Jim Willig. We'll be in the studio with another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101 today, talking about the life, work, and legacy of the Smothers Brothers. That is next hour at Rick Emerson Show. .com next hour at rickemersonshow.com.
I had no idea, and I'm excited because I'm smack in the middle of reading David Bean Cooley's book about the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour and the censorship war they went through with CBS.
And I actually, not too long ago, saw that documentary, Smothered, which is kind of the same, you know, sort of part and parcel of the same thing. So I'm eager to talk about that and also to pass along this comment from our friend Seamus, who says, Don doesn't like scotch. WTF. Please explain.
I don't like scotch, and the reasoning behind it, the best I can figure out, is because I had a really unfortunate Cutty Sark incident the night of my senior prom. And ever since then, after throwing up cheap scotch, I don't like the peaty taste of the scotch. It kind of gags me a little bit. I have had really good single malt scotch that I liked quite a bit. But it can't be really peaty scotch. It's like either Lafroy or Lagavulin, one of the two I actually like quite a bit. But I can never remember which is one, because one is super peaty and one isn't very peaty at all.
When you say peaty?
The peat moss taste from the aging of the scotch.
Like actual peat moss? I thought you were screwing with me just now.
No, that's what gives it the distinct scotch taste is peat moss.
No.
Yeah. So, and I don't like that flavor. And I find it just kind of gives me this like, you know, gag reflex when I taste it. I find it kind of nauseating.
Apparently that's the only thing that triggers your gag reflex, Don.
Just about it. That's all it. That okay. And beets.
Awesome.
To avoid the damage that alcohol, speaking of which, can cause to your stomach, a new study has found you may simply need to eat strawberry extract before you start drinking. The study, which included 36 rats divided into 6 study groups, adds to prior evidence that fruits and vegetables can protect against ulcers, cancers, and other problems in the gastrointestinal system. Antioxidants seem to explain why, according to the paper, which was published in the journal PLOS ONE. The more of a pigment called anthocyanin the rats consumed over 10 days before taking ethanol, the better the linings of their stomachs held up. Unfortunately, the results don't suggest that eating strawberries every day can help people against hangovers or other negative consequences of drinking alcohol. Maurizio Battino, coordinator of the research group at the March Polytechnic Institute in Ancona, Italy, is also the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Berry Research.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Strawberries, however, may help protect against gastric ulcers and related issues that result from viruses and other causes. Better yet, scientists may now be closer to isolating the active ingredients in strawberries and making those compounds to create better anti-inflammatory drugs and more protective antioxidant-based medicines. Battino says, for now, people should eat a complete and well-balanced diet. In this aspect, fruit plays a pivotal role. Since it is well-known, it is recommended to consume 5 to 9 fruit and vegetable portions a day. 5 to 9 fruit and vegetable
portions
a day?
That seems like a broad range of intake there.
I'm never sure exactly how much food I'm supposed to be eating.
And what is a portion?
If I'm eating like six portions of bread and 5 things of dairy and 9 things of fruit, it seems like I would never stop eating. I don't know. But anyway.
Sometimes it's sitting there on the table and I just can't pick it up.
But among them, strawberries should represent a valuable alternative.
Okay.
I do eat blueberries most days. I've started this whole regimen a couple of years ago of having most mornings I have oatmeal with blueberries in it, because oatmeal and blueberries are both very, very good for you.
And because they have
the blueberries are very, very high in antioxidants, and the fiber and the oatmeal provides quality fiber and long-lasting energy because it's a low-glycemic food that, goes into your bloodstream slowly. It's a fine, fine breakfast.
This isn't that thing that Oprah was talking about that then led to white people going and just like deforesting a whole berry place like in South America, is it?
Probably. No, is that the...
It was some berry she was talking about last year.
The acai berry, acai berry or something. The miracle fruit.
She got jerkweed Dr. Oz on there to go like, and you'll stop aging if you eat this berry. And so white people everywhere just went, huzzah!
Why that just started popping up in every like energy drink and lip gloss?
It is because
on the
of
planet.
Oprah. Because Oprah and Dr. Oz came out and Dr. Oz, who I find amusing, but who I don't actually listen to for medical advice.
God no.
And it's like I just in my mind I do like a jump cut to just some village somewhere in Sri Lanka where there's like a bunch of native peoples walking with baskets on their heads, and then there's just sort of a thundering like on the horizon, and they look over and there's just a bunch of moronic Oprah viewers just besieging their village, and then they leave and there's just a bunch of dry like Charlie Brown Christmas tree twigs just there,
and they're saying that was all our food for the winter.
Seriously,
that is what we subsist on. Damn you, Oprah. But of course, they don't know who Oprah is because they don't have TVs.
I don't know what a portion of food is in these things either.
Well, I know that a portion of meat is supposed to be the size of a deck of cards.
Really?
Or like the palm of your hand. That's how much meat you're supposed to eat in a serving.
And I'm supposed to have, 30 or 40 of those a day?
Yeah. Yeah, you're supposed to have about 12 of those.
Fantastic.
And 18 apples.
As long as I can take that in a fillet of fish.
Apparently about a half gallon of milk. Which is weird because we don't actually digest milk properly and it's not very good for us. But we're supposed to drink a lot of it.
Speak for yourself, Tim Riley. I digest milk just fine. You don't see me having to go off to the store and get a bunch of pills every time I want ice cream. So forth.
I've been drinking milk alternatives lately, by the way, because Patrick isn't supposed to drink milk. So we've been trying to find things he can drink. So I've been eating cereal with rice milk on it.
Welcome to my world. Welcome to my hell.
Which isn't actually. It's like Lewis Black said about soy milk. It's not soy milk. There are no soy boobies. It's soy juice.
Yeah. You're just drinking squeezings.
Yeah.
That's all it is. It's just chalk water.
I also thought of your wife when I bought a carton of hemp milk.
Yep. That's there
which
too.
Which I still haven't opened, by the way. It's just sitting in the fridge.
No good.
Is it bad?
I can save you the save you the trouble right now. Here's the thing about soy milk. I say, turning into a woman. The thing about soy milk, because if you go to my house, there's soy milk, there's hemp milk, there's almond milk and coconut milk and whatever. I mean, basically everything but, milk is there. Everything but cow milk. The thing about soy milk is it's not bad. You just have to divorce yourself from the idea that it's milk like you're used to drinking. Because everybody drinks it thinking, it's going to taste like milk from a cow, and it doesn't. It's like its own it's its own thing. So if you're using it in place of milk, like on cereal or something, that's going to be, you don't want to do that.
Well, I can't, I still have to, I'm okay with the rice milk on the cereal. It's just a little thin.
Well, it doesn't have a taste.
The rice milk doesn't taste too bad. I don't like soy milk very much. I still have my little carton of half and half in the door for my coffee because, none of that stuff works in coffee worth a damn.
Someone says hemp milk is like rice milk, but it tastes like grass.
Oh,
there you go.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, no, it's real thin. It lacks the creaminess of, regular milk.
So far, all I've gotten out of that is I just took a picture of it and posted it on Twitter and said, look, I bought hippie juice.
Yeah.
No,
and I don't trust any milk that you can just leave in your cupboard, like just sealed, like in a box or something. That seems fundamentally wrong to me. But what do I know? Yeah. Are we still doing science?
Yeah, because we were talking about soy.
Didn't we just start the show?
Yes.
Okay.
It's over now. No more science.
There we go. There's your Science on the March for Friday. November 4th, 2011. Coming up here in, 5 seconds or maybe longer, we have your entertainment news and next hour the Rick Emerson radio program and so forth. Here is Don Taylor at the news desk.
So here's a story that I pulled off the wires and was ready to read. And then when I checked my email later, found that 3 different people had sent it to me because they know what I like.
Excellent.
A customer at a bank in Palm Coast, Florida, got an unpleasant surprise this morning at the bank's drive-thru. A male customer of the RBC Bank apparently urinated in a bank tube Wednesday morning after he was told he couldn't purchase a money order. Later, another customer arrived and the urine spilled out of the tube onto her and her car.
Okay, wouldn't you notice if a tube was full of urine? I mean, a bank tube.
Well, I don't know. If you're like kind of, it was this
Maybe
morning.
You're in a hurry.
If you're kind of in a hurry and you're not half asleep and you pull the bank tube out and you just pull it into your car and pull it open, it could slosh on you without you realizing. Yeah.
And so how do they know it was this guy? Well, his fingerprints must have been on
and
it or something.
They have
also, they have his urine.
Cameras.
Yeah.
As
plus
well.
His...
Sheriff's deputy said the customer suspected of urinating in the tube pulled into the drive-thru around 8:50 a.m. and asked if they sold money orders. When he was told no, he became upset and mumbled something about bad customer service. A bank employee told deputies a short time later another customer pulled into the same drive-thru lane. The customer said there was liquid in the tube and that it smelled like urine. The customer then picked the tube up. Okay, she's an idiot then.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
Okay, this is after.
I now lose.
She smelled the scent of what you're, and then said, but let me pick it up and open it anyway.
Yeah, and that's when it spilled into her
car. Okay, no more sympathy.
The bank employee took the tube and also determined that it was urine.
Why? How much could you possibly be making it? Well, I guess you're making a decent wage there. You don't want to get fired. So I guess maybe if they tell you to pick up the urine, you pick up the urine.
Yeah.
All right, fine. Yeah, if I worked for, like, minimum wage and the guys like, go pick up that bucket of urine, you're like, no, I don't think so. The, you know, and also, I don't mean to gross everybody out in the lunch hour, but I mean, there are a few things in this world that smell worse than somebody's, like, stale whiz. I mean, that's just, like, one of the worst things on earth. That is, let me tell you, as a guy, I've had jobs cleaning bathrooms. That is the worst thing in the world.
It might not have been that stale, though. I mean, she might have pulled in, like, 5 minutes later. Might have still been warm.
I wonder if he was hoping that it would go
Which
through that, like, whole,
even worse
you know, that
ways.
Thing, and then, like, and then would it hit the, you know, and it would just sort of, like, projectile itself over the inside of the bank or whatever?
Yeah, see, he screwed up because of what he should have done, and I'm just going to offer this as advice for anyone in the future who wants to commit this kind of petty larceny. He should have peed in the tube. Put it into the thing and then hit
press
that
the send.
Press that button that sends it. Yeah,
because now you're punishing the wrong people. Really, you're punishing this other woman who will almost certainly sue you,
right.
Incidentally, for exposing her to a biohazard, a lawsuit she will almost certainly win. I like this. This comment sums it up. Too many people are touching this urine. Well, that is true, sir and madam. I mean, really, it's really only you should be touching your urine. No one else, unless it's a licensed
and even
professional.
Then, I don't even like to touch my. I don't want to touch my urine.
No.
So. After several hours of tracking it, Fish and Wildlife crews successfully tranquilized and captured a black bear spotted roaming in the Lakewood area of Washington early this morning. The bear, described as a black bear, about 200 to 300 pounds, had passed the Tyee Park Elementary School playground before it dashed off into the woods. Maybe it just wanted to go to school. Wildlife officials surrounded the area and managed to capture the animal. Wildlife officials were seen carrying the knocked-out animal on a tarp into a cage. The bear was first spotted early this morning in a residential neighborhood near the intersection of Bridgeport Way Southwest and Arrowhead Road Southwest. Sergeant Ted Jackson of Fish and Wildlife said the bear was jumping from yard to yard along Arrowhead.
So it was, I mean... Well, it's not like it's outside of the possibility that it was trying to get to school, because school, I think school is like a supermarket if you're a bear. You know, school is just sort of one big clothing-covered buffet.
Yeah, you got play structures and snacks.
Exactly. So it's like, so you can get exercise and a meal at the same time.
The area is, Jackson said, the dart on a very good day would take effect in 5 minutes. This time of year, bears put on quite a bit of weight, and the bear was able to jump a couple more fences. Now we're trying to find it.
Yeah, okay.
They had a search dog, and they were going backyard to backyard looking for the animal. And then finally they found it and laid it out on a tarp and hauled it away.
Okay.
And hopefully they're going to send it back into the wild.
So they always just send it right to the... I think they have an incinerator just running all the time where they just send these animals, you know? I mean, that's the sense I get, because apparently we've now passed... the point where we're going to sort of try to be understanding and go like, well, I don't know, maybe we can just release it back into its natural. There's always a guy over there who's already just like cut off its head and made it into a lamp.
Yeah. And you kind of got to understand why, because the bear is, you send the bear into the wild and the bear's going, well, screw this. I want to go back where the potato chips are.
Well, if you send the bear into the
sucks
wild.
Sucks out here.
I think it's like when you throw a stick and your dog just brings it back. I think the bear then thinks like, oh, it's a game. It's to see how fast I can get back to the Cub Scouts, you know? So.
A Texas judge made infamous this week when
screw this guy. Seriously, screw this guy long and hard.
Yeah.
You know, you've seen this story.
Yeah, I've seen the story.
Sorry.
Hit the headlines this week when his disabled daughter released a 2004 video of him
hit the headlines this week because the headlines were talking back.
viciously beating her with a belt. Won't face charges because the statute of limitations has expired.
Oh, he's going to get his, though. It doesn't. I'm telling you right now. I know people. There's going to be a reckoning.
The Associated Press reports that Arkansas County Court at Law Judge William Adams would have likely been charged with causing injury to a child or other assault-related offenses for the beating of his then 16-year-old daughter, if not for the 5-year statute of limitations. Rockport Police Chief Tim Jarrow said yesterday, "We believe that there was a criminal offense involved and that there was substantial evidence to indicate that, and under normal circumstances, a charge would have been made." He added that officers will discuss the case with federal prosecutors, even though it's unlikely the federal charges would apply.
Have you seen the video?
No, thank God.
It really is just horrid. And I'm not encouraging people to go look at it, but I mean, if you really want to get a sense for, so if anybody doesn't know what we're talking about, this video surfaced on the Intertron because his older daughter had filmed it some years back.
Well,
apparently,
she's 23 now, and
he's always been an abusive dick, apparently. Yeah. And so she surreptitiously filmed him whacking on the younger daughter, who has cerebral palsy, by the way, and then kind of kept the video like in her back pocket, and then apparently because the dad, you know. Because he was working through his issue. He was getting much better, said the mom.
He was very angry at her because she was 16 and she had been downloading music and games illegally from the internet. So he whipped her with a belt, despite her sustained pleas for him to stop.
Well, and the best part of the video, and by best I mean most deserving of its own kind of beating, is when he comes back into frame, and there are different versions of the sort of the story going around in terms of why, what provoked him to do it, because the older daughter actually said, I mean, not that it matters at all, the older daughter actually said, you know, came to the younger daughter's defense and said that she was not, in fact, engaging in any illegal activity, that she was on the internet, period, and that the dad was not a big fan of that, because the internet is where, you know, Satan lives. Incidentally, it's worth noting that his beliefs about the internet have been proven true since the internet has just effed that guy long and hard, so hard he'll probably never walk right again. But, so he catches his daughter on the internet, and then just goes to work on her with the belt, you know. And it does really take a special breed of man to be wailing on a 16-year-old girl who has cerebral palsy, you know, repeatedly for like 5-6 minutes.
And by the way, he is a judge who, as part of his job, he presides over child abuse cases.
Yeah, and he's, you know, he's like Mr. Johnny Law. And so then he goes out of frame at one point. The mom takes over, either because, depending on who you listen to and how you view this, the mom then takes over the beating, either because she's also a psychopathic thug, or because she figures, well, if I do the beating, at least it'll be softer. Since I'm keeping my children in this house, it's the least I can do to beat them myself. And then the dad comes back into frame, and he then continues the beating even harder than before. Because, and this is all on video, by the way, you can watch the entire thing. He continues the beating. And then he says, by way of explanation for the, you know, part three of the wailing of his child, he says, well, she already got her punishment, but I didn't get my licks in. Because, you know.
Yeah.
So there you go. And so finally, but the older daughter had this video footage, and apparently the dad had just gotten worse and worse and worse over the years, and she went, okay, internet, you handle this. So.
Yeah, he says that, he claims the video looks worse than it is.
Yeah. Okay.
And released a 3-page statement in his defense. He says the video's release was, quote, to get back at him for telling her he would be reducing the amount of financial support he gives her and for taking away her Mercedes. She says her father was developing a pattern of abuse.
Yeah.
Here's the thought.
This is what, Adams won?
Yeah.
I think he's in serious denial because I told him it hurt to walk the next day. And his response was one word. He said, good.
Adam said she set up a camera in her room because the corporal punishment she received as a child was turning into abuse.
It got so bad, and I recognized the pattern of it about to erupt, that I knew to set up the camera, and I knew that I just needed to capture this because it was getting so bad.
Yeah, so she uploaded it to wherever, and then I actually first heard about it from Seamus because he saw it when it appeared on Reddit, and the Reddit camp As folks like this are wont to do. The Reddit camp immediately just decided, well, F this guy. And so, and they immediately found, the page for the county and his own page, like as a judge, and then his family's address and his, you know, whatever. And by, you know, within like an hour, all of his voicemail boxes were overflowing. And then the next day they'd all been disconnected. And then the day after that, And the other great thing about Reddit is then they helpfully tipped off all of the local news organizations who then showed up on his front lawn the next morning. So that was a pleasant way to wake up for him. I guess the mom has subsequently like left the house or no longer lives there or whatever. But she's certainly there and certainly participating and abetting in the video. The video really is like if anybody questions her versions of things, the video is really it is just horrifying in a way that that few things are. So he'll. He's going to get his. The internet. That's the thing about the internet is the internet really just sort of the internet has a long, long, patient memory. I think for these things. So
good.
Yes.
A German website is offering its customers the option of having cows slaughtered in the field while they graze for a different tasting beef. Customers at www.mycow.de, based in the northeastern German state of Mecklenburg, Western Pomerania. Can choose whether cows are killed traditionally in the old slaughterhouse style or in a field while they're happy and grazing. You know, like sort of surprise, bam.
Oh, I think it's a surprise either way. Cows aren't really, I don't think their deductive powers are as advanced as we might think.
Considered more humane, the field method apparently provides tastier beef because the cow isn't unduly stressed before its death. Apparently surging adrenaline during strenuous slaughterhouse killing toughens up their meat. Although I can't imagine the cow doesn't experience adrenaline when a guy just starts walking towards him
with like, a chainsaw,
with a shotgun and a chainsaw.
Hey, look over there for a second.
Yeah. The field killing method is more expensive and difficult, so few farmers use it. A 5-kilogram packet of my cow meat starts at about 75 euros, whatever that is. This is a much more gentle slaughtering process, said Suzanne Marks, the website's operator, saying the beef they sell comes from happier cows.
They don't know that the fear is the best tasting part, Dawn.
It's a gentler slaughter method.
Yeah. I don't really know that if you were to poll cows in the field about this, that they'd be able to describe to you, like the whole, you know, I don't think the concept of the pneumatic, the air gun has really entered the cow lexicon at this point. I think they think they're just going to like another building where there's different grass.
They think they're like in line for like Star Tours at Disneyland or something.
Star Tours. Of all things cows could be in line for, why would you pick Star Tours?
I don't know. Space Mountain? Maybe?
Is this Captain EO?
I love Michael Jackson.
Well, that looks like it's coming right at me.
Sorry.
The 3D experience.
Okay.
Let's do our entertainment news.
Okay, here's your entertainment news. It's about time that I go on vacation, I think. Here's your entertainment news for Friday, November 4th.
The Spanish government says it has granted citizenship to singer Ricky Martin and actor Benicio del Toro. Spokesman Jose Blanco said Friday that Martin and Del Toro were recognized for their artistic talents and that the government was happy they wished to have Spanish nationality. Both Martin and Del Toro are from Puerto Rico and have U.S. citizenship. Spain normally obliges people to renounce any other nationality they have before granting them a Spanish passport, but it makes exceptions for citizens from Latin American countries and some other places, including Puerto Rico.
Wait, so you say that, but it didn't grant them citizenship like as a couple?
No.
Because that would be
not
hot.
That we know of.
Okay.
It was not immediately clear why the two celebrities sought Spanish citizenship.
Oh, I think we know.
The wife of deceased actor Wyatt Knight, who played Tommy Turner in the Porky's movies, confirms the actor took his own life, saying he wanted to escape the physical and emotional pain caused by intense cancer treatments. TMZ broke the story when Wyatt's body was discovered on October 26th in Maui, and cops believed the death was a suicide. Now Wyatt's wife, Sylvina Knight, said it's true. Wyatt recently overcame a battle with cancer, but the radiation therapy left him in both physical and emotional pain. She adds, he was tired of the pain and after much contemplation, chose to end his life in a beautiful and serene place. It's unclear if Sylvina was aware of Wyatt's alleged suicide plot before he died, but she claims his family and friends are devastated. By now you have probably heard that Leonardo DiCaprio and Armie Hammer will kiss each other in the movie J. Edgar.
Does Armie Hammer play Clyde Tolson?
Yes.
Ah, yes.
DiCaprio stars in the Oscar buzzy film as late FBI boss J. Edgar Hoover, with Hammer taking on the role of Clyde Tolson, Hoover's right-hand man, who many believe was also his lover. There was no concrete evidence proving or disproving that Hoover was gay, so it's going to be up to moviegoers to make up their own mind.
He just seems like a raging queen, though.
In a way
that, like, just exudes from every pore of his being in every interview and every photograph you've ever seen of him.
And just that kind of self-loathing sort of thing as well. DiCaprio, at the premiere of the film, said, "To tell you the truth, I don't have an answer to that question. I don't think there's anyone still alive who really does. So if you talk to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, they are staunch believers that these two men carried out a very professional relationship and that they were sort of inseparable pals." DiCaprio also said, "These two men went on every vacation together. They ate breakfast, lunch, and dinner together. They went to work together. They were together for 50 years. They lived together. They were buried together. They never had a family. They never had a girlfriend. You know, put it together in your mind."
Yeah, it's not like it's... Yeah, this is not really something that requires an Herculean... wait, what am I looking for? Hercule? Yeah, Poirot, right?
Yes,
okay. Et cetera, the thing. Is the deal that he plays young Hoover here, or does he play him throughout his whole life?
He plays youngish Hoover. I mean, DiCaprio's...
Because oldest Hoover looks like Bob
DiCaprio's
Hoskins.
DiCaprio's in his 40s now, so...
Yeah, but I mean, Hoover's a big guy, though. He was a substantial man.
Well, DiCaprio's been getting beefier as he's gotten older, and he looks pretty beefy for this.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
Director Clint Eastwood said that if Hoover was gay, there was no way he would have identified as a gay man, especially in the 1930s. I don't do Clint Eastwood. "He had an inseparable pal," Eastwood said. "Whether it went from there, I don't know."
I think you're just doing Michael Rooker.
Yeah, I don't do Clint Eastwood. Screenwriter Dustin Lance Black said the romantic status of the relationship had to be kept a bit vague. "So I think the audience will come away like they have clear answers, but we do leave some things up in the air. We allow the audience to watch behavior and observe things that went on and to draw their own conclusions." Echoing this one, so I guess this takes place in... Well, it says in 1919, when Hoover was 24 years old in his sexual prime, no one said they were gay because they would lose their family, their job, and everything. I'm sure that Leonardo DiCaprio is not playing 24.
Well,
he's not going to be able to get away with that.
He's one of our greatest actors, Don. One doesn't really like to think about J. Edgar Hoover being in his sexual prime. It's just a lot of sloshing and grunting.
Yeah.
All right.
And finally, since his sex reassignment surgery, Chaz Bono is very much alive and plans to stay that way. The transgender activist is threatening to sue the National Enquirer over a cover story in its upcoming issue in which the tabloid claims he'll die within 4 years because of purported health issues stemming from his gender transition. Chaz's lawyer, Dina LaPault, sent a cease and desist letter obtained by E! News to the Enquirer, accusing the magazine of defamation and demanding it print a retraction and apology for a headline declaring, "Chaz Bono, : only 4 years to live! !" Liver damage agony.
I'm sorry, I'm not laughing at liver damage. I mean, I kind of am.
Well, yeah.
But only as a headline.
Yeah.
Does it do the Enquirer thing of doing, you know, pal's fear?
Probably, yeah.
Okay.
Friends terrified,
right,
for he-she star. Anyway.
The scientific term is SHRM.
Oh, yeah. So they said, no, this isn't true. Knock it off. Go away. A rep for the magazine defended its piece, saying, "We've invited Mr. Bono and or his medical experts to respond to the opinions of our medical experts in the next issue of the National Enquirer. The published opinions in the current edition are mostly focused on Mr. Bono's serious weight issues, which, if not addressed, could substantially shorten his life." So.
We got like 30 seconds here.
There was a bomb team called to investigate a device on the MAX train last night. 11 p.m., cops were found. Told there was a device on an eastbound MAX train. They stopped the train, evacuated at the transit center, went in, found something that was left behind a passenger. Wasn't a bomb.
Okay.
Everybody went home. The end.
And we're done. Just a brief note that next week there will be new episodes of Legion of News with Mr. Big Jim Willig filling in this chair right here alongside Don Taylor. And that'll be the case in the Rick Emerson Show as well. Speaking of the Rick Emerson radio program, that begins next hour. And with that, we bring down the curtain on this, another exciting episode of Legion of News. We come to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the Milk Packing District in glorious Southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, Don Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Hagel, chief of staff Cheryl Kanakoa. As always, we thank you for listening. And don't forget, you can get this program later today via iTunes or as a direct MP3 download here or at legionofnews.com. And you can take it with your new mobile device if you like it, mobile.cascadia.fm. Thank you for listening. The program will return on Monday. Have a safe and satisfying weekend, won't you?